Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a veteran journalist and editor of a progressive publication whose interview with Stephen Bannon appears to have been the final straw that led to the firing of the White House's chief strategist. Robert Kuttner, the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect and a former chief investigator for the U.S. Senate Banking Committee, whose latest book is Debtor's Prison, The Politics of Austerity versus Possibility, joins us. We'll discuss his article at The American Prospect, Steve Bannon, Unrepentant, and the battle lines in the White House that Bannon declared between the economic nationalists who want to make America great again and Bannon's enemies at the Defense Department, State Treasury, and the National Economic Council, and those inside the White House who want to contain Trump. Now that Bannon is gone, will the war still rage on, with Trump poised to stir up ethno-nationalism again on Tuesday in Arizona, where he will insist on building the border wall and may pardon a racist sheriff famous for his harsh treatment of Latinos? Then we'll speak with Robert Weissman, the president of Public Citizen, about the contrast between Trump's plans to slash government spending and cut the budgets of agencies that protect public health and the environment and help low-income Americans, and Trump and his family's lavish spending on frequent travel to and from luxury resorts at home and abroad, for which the taxpayer picks up the tab for the 1,100 Secret Service agents protecting Trump and his family, spending for which has drained the Secret Service budget, with costs already meeting federally mandated caps for overtime and expenses meant to last for all of 2017. Then finally, we'll get an analysis of why there have been four expensive ships of the United States Navy's 7th Fleet involved in collisions or run aground this year, prompting the Navy's top admiral to order a fleet-wide operational pause. A former commissioned officer in the U.S. Navy who served aboard the USS Ticonderoga, Christopher Preble, the Vice President for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute and author of The Power Problem, How American Dominance Makes Us Less Safe, joins us to discuss the latest collision off Singapore between a tanker and the USS John S. McCain that has left 10 sailors missing. And joining us now is Robert Kuttner, the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect and a senior fellow at Demos. He was formerly an assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone, a chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee, and for 20 years wrote a column for Business Week. His books include A Presidency in Peril, The Insider Story of Obama's Promise, Wall Street's Power, and The Struggle to Control Our Economic Future. His latest book is Debtor's Prison, The Politics of Austerity versus Possibility. And he has an article at The American Prospect, Steve Bannon, Unrepentant. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Kuttner.
Well, I'm delighted to be with you as always.
And do you feel responsible for Stephen Bannon losing his job at the White House?
Well, maybe that phone call was the last straw. I think only Stephen Bannon is responsible for Stephen Bannon losing his job, but I'd like to think I helped.
So what prompted him to call? What was the first thing he told you? I mean, was it one of those things where this is the White House calling?
No, it was, I got an email from his assistant saying that Mr. Bannon would like to speak with you, would like to meet with you at the White House. And I said, well, I'm flattered, but I'm on vacation, and why don't we talk, I won't be back till Labor Day, why don't we talk by phone? So he said, let me check with Mr. Bannon, and then he called back and said, yes, Mr. Bannon will be calling shortly. So then Bannon called and did the usual number where, you know, he flatters me. He's been reading me for years. He's thrilled to finally talk to me. And we're soulmates on the issue of how to deal with China and how to deal with free trade. And so that's what he wanted to talk about. And, you know, there's a theory here called enough rope. And we talked about that for a while. And then I steered the conversation around to other things. I think what's a little odd is you have to wonder how this guy's mind works. So whether or not he'd already been fired, and the narrative has gone back and forth on that, I think the latest version, I think the authoritative version is in the New York Times this morning that he hadn't quite been fired, that Trump was resisting firing him, even though everybody else wanted to fire him, and this was the last straw. But if you're Stephen Bannon, why would you call Bob Kuttner? Leaving aside the fact that he made a kind of a rookie error, which is also wildly improbable, in not saying, hey, this is off the record. So piecing this together, his notion is that there's a you know, there's a grand left-right bargain to be had on economic nationalism, and he wants to recruit lefties like me. And there are other people who have been critical of America's China policy and free trade policy in ways that sort of partly parallel Bannon. He wants to recruit us to his side. And friends of mine who have also been critical have been spoken to by Bannon. But what's weird is you have to ask yourself, how could Bannon think that this would strengthen his hand at the White House? You can imagine him trotting into a meeting of the National Security Council with the State Department, Treasury, Defense Department, U.S. Trade Rep, and saying, hey, I got Bob Kuttner on my side. I mean, that doesn't exactly enhance your credibility at the Trump White House. The other thing that's weird is if he knew that he was hanging by a thread, why would he behave so recklessly? And I guess my tentative answer to that is this is who he is. He's a swashbuckler, and it's kind of damn the torpedoes. I'm going to do what I'm going to do. Let my enemies do what they're going to do.
Well, do you think in general, though, this is a case where obviously Donald Trump himself has not got past the campaign? FDR once said there are two kind of people in politics, those that help you get elected and those that help you govern. And Donald Trump doesn't appear to know how to govern. And Stephen Bannon, I think, is in that category as well, is he not? He's a campaigner. He's a bomb thrower. He inflames the and by the way, why would he talk to a liberal? He spends all his time on Breitbart, making
he would talk to a left liberal critic of free trade. Mm-hmm. I can sort of get my mind around that. But let me respond to what you said. I think, unlike Trump, and some of this was in what he said to me, Bannon has a kind of a grand strategy of how to proceed. So one part is you fan the flames of white supremacy, and you get Democrats talking about race, and hey, there are more white people than there are black people, so I can win that one, says Bannon. And then you also talk about economic nationalism so that you actually deliver something in the way of jobs to the white working class. Now, it's appalling. The racist part is absolutely appalling, but at least it's a coherent strategy. Trump doesn't have a coherent strategy because Trump is sufficiently in bed with the corporate types that he's not going to turn away from so-called free trade. Gary Cohn and all his corporate buddies like the status quo too much. So all that's left of Trump's version of this is the racism. And I think the other question I'm left with is, what kind of role does Bannon play going forward? Does he continue to try and be part of Trump's kitchen cabinet, no longer subject to the discipline of General Kelly because he's no longer at the White House, but he's still on the end of the phone coaching Trump on his version of how to do this? Or does he join Breitbart's current line and kick Trump for being a sellout? And conversely, how does Trump respond? Trump doesn't like to be kicked by staffers. Trump doesn't like to be upstaged by staffers. And so does Trump now double down on the racist white nationalism, or does he pull back and try to have a rapprochement with the establishment Republicans? And there are mixed signals on that, too. I mean, Trump said something surprisingly mainstream about the Boston rally, where the white nationalists were overwhelmed by 40 or 50,000 protesters and were contained in a little tiny area. And the Boston police and the Massachusetts State Police did what was not done in Charlottesville. And Trump sounded very mainstream in sort of praising the lack of violence. But tomorrow he's going to go to Phoenix and probably pardon Joe Arpaio, which suggests he's going to double down on the white supremacy. So, you wonder this sort of dialectic of Bannon's influence on Trump, which way Trump's going to play it, which way Bannon's going to play it. And ultimately, of course, Bannon is a sideshow. The real question is what's going to become of Trump.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Kuttner, the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect and a senior fellow at Demos. He was formerly an assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone, a chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee, and for 20 years wrote a column for Business Week. His books include A Presidency in Peril, The Insider Story of Obama's Promise, Wall Street's Power, and the struggle to control our economic future. And his latest book is Debt as Prison, The Politics of Austerity versus Possibility. And he has an article at The American Prospect, Steve Bannon, Unrepentant. But Robert Kuttner, we wouldn't be talking about Bannon but for his patron, I don't think, Robert Mercer, who's financed both Breitbart and some of Bannon's wacky movies. And he, the day after he talked to you on last Wednesday, Bannon spent several hours at the Long Island estate of Robert Mercer. And then, then the next evening, Robert Mercer had dinner with Donald Trump. So what's going on there? Do you think that the one person that perhaps Donald Trump may have to defer to is the guy who's the biggest donor to his presidential election?
Well, Trump doesn't need Mercer. Mercer needs Trump. And you know, Bannon coaches Mercer on what to say. So Bannon's still trying to pull the strings through Mercer. And that's interesting. So, you know, I don't have a crystal ball. I just have some hunches here. But it will be very interesting in the next week or two to see, first, if Trump doubles down on the racism and the white nationalism and the kind of encouragement of the most scurrilous elements in society, or does he pull back? And number two, does Bannon be nice cop or does he be bad cop? Does he try and influence Trump through back channels, or does he kick him? Because Bannon, because Breitbart's game is to kick him, or maybe it's a nice cop, bad cop routine where you know, Mercer and Bannon are sort of still talking to him in the middle of the night, and Breitbart's publicly kicking him.
But it seems, though, that there's some kind of a game going on here. But in terms of the meetings of the mind, my understanding is that the so-called adults who are now buttressed by General Kelly spend a lot of their time trying to talk sense into Donald Trump, who gets all kinds of weird ideas from Fox, Breitbart, and from Alex Jones. And my understanding, and I think to some extent he unmasked himself last Tuesday in Trump Tower at that bizarre press conference, and that's pretty much how he is in private, the person we saw in public ranting at the press. So my understanding is that Mercer is also a bit of a conspiracy theorist, if not a kind of right-wing crackpot. So what's going on in that regard? Bannon sounds like he uses rhetoric. In fact, some of the quotes in the interview he did with you made him sound like a lefty. So and calling the marchers in Charlottesville a bunch of clowns. So
no, but that was total BS. I mean, look, he said what? First of all, let's assume that he'd forgotten that we were on the record. So he's trying to ingratiate himself with me. I mean, he didn't believe a word of that because those are his stormtroopers, and so I completely discount that. And to the extent that there's a little bit of an overlap between my views and his views, it has to do with the stupidity of America's policy vis-a-vis China. But then, you know, in the latter part of the interview, he went on to talk about his strategy of using white races to force the Democrats to talk about race and identity, which he believes is a minority politics, whereas his version of majority politics is to pull together the far right and angry white working class people who don't feel that that folks like Hillary Clinton are doing anything for them. And at least that's a coherent theory. Trump's version of racism is kind of make it up as you go along. So, and as I said before, the economic nationalist part of the package that Bannon is trying to sell Trump and trying to sell the country is precluded by Trump being in bed with all these multinational corporations. So I suppose we can be thankful that Trump is not as coherent as Bannon, and that Bannon is now on the outs. But the bigger story here is that Trump continues to go down in flames. He continues to run a chaotic White House. He continues to go through staff. He continues to lose popular support. And even though it's kind of fun to talk about Bannon, we really need to keep our eye on that ball.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Yeah. Pleasure talking with you.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Kudner, the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect and a senior fellow at Demos. He was formerly an assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone, a chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee, and for 20 years wrote a column for Business Week. His books include A Presidency in Peril, The Insider Story of Obama's Promise, Wall Street's Power, and The Struggle for Control of Our Economic Future. And his latest book is Debtor's Prison, The Politics of Austerity versus Possibility. And he has an article at The American Prospect, Steve Bannon, Unrepentant. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into Trump's plans to slash spending to help low-income Americans while his own family's lavish spending on travel to luxury hotels has drained the Secret Service budget. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Robert Weissman, the president of Public Citizen and an expert on economic, healthcare, trade, and globalization, intellectual property, and regulatory policy, and issues related to financial accountability and corporate responsibility. He's written extensively on corporate accountability, access to medicines, corporate influence over the political process, the World Trade Organization, and regulations of the financial markets. His top priorities include climate change, healthcare reform, financial regulation, and campaign finance reform. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Weissman.
Hey, it's good to be with you.
And it's pretty extraordinary that the Trump family and President Trump have all but bankrupted the Secret Service in terms of the money that's allocated to them for their protective details, which include both the president and his family. I guess for a high roller, do you think Trump has any concept that he's draining the public's coffers?
Well, I don't think he cares. You know, the irony, of course, is that he criticized President Obama for taking too many vacations. Obama didn't actually take that many vacations. But Trump is away on vacation pretty much every single weekend. And one consequence of that is that the Secret Service has to be in tow, and he has racked up these huge overtime bills for the Secret Service agents, and they've basically hit the top of their budget allocation for the fiscal year.
But there are also 18 members of the Trump family, and they seem to travel a lot, do they not? And the sons go off and do business, making money for Trump and his organization since he's handed over the reins to them, even though he still owns these companies in violation of traditions of past presidents.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, if we want to be fair to Trump, there are more family members who were required to receive Secret Service protection than was the case with Obama, family members and close associates. But a huge portion of what he's racking up is because of the detail that has to follow him around as he travels from one Trump-branded property to another. And the fees for the time spent at the Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida have really been quite high and are a big part of why the Secret Service has already run through their entire budget for the year.
And above and beyond the 18 members of Trump's immediate family, altogether apparently 42 people receive Secret Service protection, which is an increase from 31 people during the Obama administration. Do you have any idea who those extra people are?
No, I don't. I mean, I think some of it has to do with a larger family than, you know, family of the family. And so on. I'm not sure that the 41 is particularly improper, so there may have been some natural increase in cost. But a lot of it, again, has to do, as you say, first with some of the children jetting off around the world in advance of their business interests, and secondly, and I think even more importantly, with the president just leaving the White House almost every weekend to go on vacation.
And apparently it costs $3 million per visit to Mar-a-Lago, and that the Secret Service have to spend $60,000 on golf cart rentals at both Mar-a-Lago and Bedminster, both of Trump's golf clubs. So, again, the government is putting money into Trump's pockets. That's what happens when they protect the, or at least they're contributing to a profit-making enterprise, are they not?
Yeah, that's right. Now, the Secret Service is not doing anything wrong. Their policy is they pay fair market value for the resources they use, so they actually paid some small amount, for example, to Joe Biden when they had occupied a property that he owned. But it's an entirely different affair with President Trump, who has these estates and golf courses. You know, why do they need to be renting golf carts? It's to trail the president as he goes around on his different golf courses. So this is of a character never before seen in American history.
Well, it's extraordinary the kind of money that's been run up just on the kids. You've got, apart from their business, I mean, for example, Eric Trump took a business trip to Uruguay that cost $100,000 in hotel bills. And then you've got trips to Vancouver to open a Trump building, to Istanbul, to Dubai for opening Trump's international golf club. Ivanka Trump and her husband, Jared Kushner, they had to have, obviously, they had to have security during their ski holiday in Aspen, Colorado last March. And I take it they also just got back from a vacation in Vermont, where presumably they also had coverage. But the one person who seems to be running up huge bills is Tiffany Trump. She, along with her boyfriend, have gone on trips to Germany and Hungary. And then she also took a trip with Marla Maples, the former girlfriend of Trump's, and her mother. They took a trip to the Mediterranean and ran up $60,000 in hotel bills. So they all stay in pretty posh places, it seems.
I think that's how the billionaire class does it, yes. And then the natural consequences of the expenses for the Secret Service are higher than they would be for a more Holiday Inn president.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Weissman, the president of Public Citizen and an expert on economic, healthcare, trade and globalization, intellectual property and regulatory policy, and issues related to financial accountability and corporate responsibility. He's written extensively on corporate accountability, access to medicines, corporate influence over the political process, the World Trade Organization and regulation of the financial markets. His top priorities include climate change, healthcare reform, financial regulation and campaign finance reforms. And just in terms of the work that you do and your priorities, Robert Weissman, you couldn't be more depressed by this guy, right? He just closed down the Office of Climate Change, and he's tried to kill healthcare reform, which mercifully has survived. Financial regulation doesn't happen, and campaign finance reform is a distant dream. Do we really have a plutocratic government at this point? Well, you've got the Koch brothers, who apparently have even more influence than ever. Everything that the House and Senate has got done so far seems to be at the behest of the Koch brothers. And then you've got this fellow Robert Mercer, who's Stephen Bannon's mentor and financier. He showed up at the White House on Thursday night to have dinner with Donald Trump. What's your read, since you've followed and tried to sort of clean house there in Washington for many, many, many years, if not decades? Has Washington been captured by money, and Donald Trump is this sort of the Gilded Age president?
Yes. So I think it's possible at this moment to have this seem a little fuzzy because of the break between, you know, a number of CEOs and Trump over Charlottesville. Now, that's the CEOs left the advisory councils of the president, not because they had some sudden outbreak of conscience, but because they were pressured to by their employees and especially by consumers. So, but there's been some reporting at the moment that makes it seem like there's this huge cleavage between corporate America and the Trump administration. And that's sort of partially true in this very micro sense of looking at Charlottesville. But if you step back from that and look at the what's actually going on throughout the government and the overall tenor of this administration, what it actually represents is the complete corporate takeover of the U.S. government, both in terms of people, well, starting with the president, the people in the White House, and then especially the cabinet officials and the sub-cabinet people who come entirely, or at least overwhelmingly, from corporate America, and who are driving forward the Chamber of Commerce slash Koch brother agenda of massive rollbacks of the regulatory protections on which we all depend for our health and safety, protection from getting ripped off by predatory corporations, and more, on the one hand, and on the other hand, massive tax cuts. That's the real corporate agenda, deregulation and tax cuts, and those are the priorities of the Trump administration and the Republican Congress. Corporate America has their people on the inside, and they're determined to deliver on this agenda. The good news is that the public mobilization in response to the Trump administration stopped the proposed rollback on Medicaid expansion, the protections of the Affordable Care Act, and I think we're on track to block significant portions of what they're trying to do as well.
So do you think people have been lulled into a sense that this chaos and paralysis in the White House is stopping a kind of malignant agenda? Because if you look at what everything that's been passed by the House, for example, it's entirely the Koch brothers' agenda, bringing in the tar sands pipeline from tar sands oil, upping up offshore drilling, crippling the EPA, getting out of the Paris Accords. You name it, everything that they've done, in fact, all they've done so far, from what I can tell, has been a benefit to the Koch brothers. So is this what's going on, that somehow people are rejoicing the paralysis in the White House? Meanwhile, a lot of mendacity is going on, and perhaps the craziness is helping disguise this mendacity.
Yeah, the idea that nothing is happening, that there's complete gridlock, is wrong. It's correct that there's legislative gridlock, which is affirmatively good right now because the alternative is a lot of bad things happening. And with some important exceptions, Congress is pretty stuck. And I think the odds are good they're going to be stuck on moving forward on a massive tax cut if we can mobilize successfully. But within the administration, the effort to roll back the regulatory protections on which we all depend is proceeding at a pace with no precedent in American history, whether it's removing protections from students at for-profit colleges or enabling investment advisors to rip off people's retirement funds, to roll back just about everything that the Environmental Protection Agency has done in the last decade. This administration is moving fast to try to deliver for corporate America.
And you don't see much of a cleavage there then, that Bannon and the sort of rebellion of his represents the idea that he's against the globalists, which is in many ways a kind of code for Jewish bankers, the cosmopolitans, this kind of talk that's coming out of him now as he's left the White House and he's got his hands on his Breitbart weapons and is ready to declare war against the Gary Cohns, the Wall Street types. Is there a cleavage between the Bannonites and Trump's base and the globalists, the Goldman Sachs types?
Yeah, there are several fault lines, and they're pretty complicated. But I think at the end of the day, on almost every one of these issues, the big corporations are winning. Now, when it comes to rolling back regulations, Bannon, the person, appears to agree. That's part, when he talked about deconstructing the administrative state, that really meant removing health, safety, environmental, financial, and other regulatory protections. So he seems to be in line with the Chamber of Commerce on that, including, apparently, on rolling back the financial protection rules of the Dodd-Frank legislation and others. They have divisions, the Bannon forces and the Goldman Sachs forces on international trade issues. Bannon's views a bit more complicated. The Wall Street corporate view pretty much antithetical to the public interest. In those debates, the Goldman Sachs faction currently is prevailing. So now, of course, Bannon and the people, what he personally thinks doesn't necessarily line up with what people who identify with Breitbart think on issues of regulatory protections, for example. If you ask, you can poll on expanding Medicaid, raising the minimum wage, health and safety protections, environmental rules. Those aren't just supported, by the resistance. Every one of those things is supported by 80% or more of the American public, which means that is inclusive of even the Breitbart crowd. Not surprisingly, regular people don't think it's a good idea to have their air polluted or their water poisoned. They don't want their workplaces to be too safe to work at. So even those people don't line up with Bannon's representation on these issues, and they definitely don't line up with the Chamber of Commerce and the Koch brothers.
But since we have a money-driven system, and he who has the most money wins in Washington, that seems to be the way it is since Citizens United, what is then going on with Bannon and his patron, Robert Mercer? Isn't it a case of he who pays the piper? In other words, he funds Breitbart. He funded all of Bannon's peculiar movies. He met with him on Wednesday for several hours at Mercer's Long Island estate. And then on Thursday night, Mercer had dinner with Donald Trump. So what do you think the agenda there is for Mercer as a plutocrat who's the biggest donor to Donald Trump?
Well, as best anyone can ascertain, Mercer's agenda isn't so far off from the Koch brothers, sort of this extreme corporate libertarianism, maybe with an extra dose of anti-immigrant policy and a concern about Israel that doesn't seem to be very motivating for the Koch brothers. It's hard to figure out all these different factions, but there's no question we sort of, what Mercer has supported, what Bannon's trying to push, it's a variant of the corporate agenda. Where they clash with, or at least where Bannon clashes with Goldman Sachs, is on some international trade issues where he has sort of complicated and sometimes contradictory views. But on the rest of the corporate libertarian agenda, there's not really much division between the Koch brothers and Goldman Sachs, except that, and again, I'm sort of interchanging Koch brothers and Bannon there, except that those factions are more extreme on, for example, denying the existence of climate change and wanting to, or thinking that they can either repeal the laws of science or some way buy themselves a personal exemption from the effects of climate change.
So how does this social division being caused, this cleavage that Bannon and company and this particular White House and most of all this president who hasn't tried to heal the nation, all presidents after traumas like mass killings, etc., try to heal the nation, bring everybody together and offer comfort as opposed to division and anger, which is what Trump projects. And Bannon is the megaphone for that through Breitbart, along with Fox News, Alex Jones, etc. And we know that Donald Trump is influenced by this, the stuff that he sees on Fox, reads on Breitbart, and sees on Alex Jones. So is there an agenda to divide America? What possible benefit would it be to the plutocrats to have racial tension in this country?
Well, I think there is a division there. Bannon and probably Trump, I'm not sure he's so thoughtful or articulate about it, do want to play up those divides. They do want to mobilize the angry white base, including in ways that attack the establishment. You know, the more Chamber of Commerce corporate view, the establishment view, as it were, obviously wants to preserve the establishment. They don't want people stoked up. They're also, you know, sort of socially liberal enough that they don't obviously want to associate with the KKK or Nazis, and they don't want to play around with that. But they also have no interest in stoking up racial or other divisions because they want stability in society. The Bannon faction, and I think he's right when he says Trump's heart is with him on this, they do want instability. They see that as the mechanism to drive forward their agenda. And on that, I think they've got actually a meaningful philosophic difference with Goldman Sachs, Wall Street, and sort of the general corporate America viewpoint.
Well, just in closing, to return to the Secret Service reaching their budget caps, 1,100 Secret Service agents have already met the federally mandated caps for overtime and salary limits. And, of course, we know that President Trump is prepared and wants to slash the budgets of almost every agency, State Department by 30%, et cetera, and eliminate a bunch of vital programs such as heating aid for low-income Americans. But on the other hand, he clearly has no qualms about the profligate spending that he's forcing the Secret Service into. So what's your sense then of is there a shame factor here? I mean, just to have the guy, you know, not have to sort of live this gilded life, is it possible for a little austerity since he's asking the rest of the government to accept austerity?
No. I think we'd be foolish if we think there's any if Donald Trump has the capacity to feel shame. I mean, I think that the juxtaposition you're raising is exactly right. It's actually not the biggest deal in the world that they're overspending the Secret Service budget. But what makes it so outrageous is that on the one hand, it's being done as he travels from branded property to branded property. But on the other hand, even worse is that he's overspending the Secret Service budget at the exact moment that he's talking about slashing spending in the most vicious and cruel ways throughout the government, including particularly programs that target and benefit low-income Americans. That is an utter disgrace. And a person who had a sense of shame would feel bad about it. But Donald Trump is not that person.
Robert Weissman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Weissman, who's the president of Public Citizen, an expert on economic, healthcare, trade, and globalization, intellectual property, and regulatory policy, and issues related to financial accountability and corporate responsibility. He's written extensively on corporate accountability, access to medicines, corporate influence over the political process, the World Trade Organization, and regulation of the financial markets. His top priorities include climate change, healthcare reform, financial regulation, and campaign finance reform. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with an analysis of why there have been four expensive ships of the U.S. Navy's 7th Fleet involved in collisions or run aground this year.
If I were a rich man, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum, all day long I bidda-bidda-bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum. If I were a bitter, bitter rich, idle, diddle, diddle, diddle man, I'd build.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Christopher Preble, who is the Vice President for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. He is the author of The Power Problem, How American Military Dominance Makes Us Less Safe, Less Prosperous, and Less Free. And he co-edited with John Mueller, A Dangerous World, Threat Perceptions, and U.S. National Security. Preble was a commissioned officer in the U.S. Navy and served aboard the USS Ticonderoga. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christopher Preble.
Thank you.
So what do you make of the number of collisions with the U.S. Navy for this year? Two guided missile destroyers now out of commission, the USS John McCain and the Fitzgerald, two guided missile cruisers, also one of which is still out of commission. It ran aground in Tokyo Bay, and the other collided with a South Korean fishing vessel. So is there something systemic going on here? It's a little coincidental, isn't it?
I think it is coincidental, and I think it's too soon to say that there's a pattern. These sorts of accidents all sort of take on a life and character of their own. That's not to say that occasionally gaps in training or areas where you can focus on sort of improving the performance of bridge watch standers and others responsible for navigating a ship safely. There are so many factors that can go into accidents like these that it appears, at least from my perspective, that it is a tragic coincidence, but not more than that.
So what explains the idea that in this modern era of radar, et cetera, that somehow or other, and I don't know how many people are on the bridge, and I think that at least the last two accidents with the guided missile destroyers, the Fitzgerald and now the John S. McCain, I don't know what the number of complement would be. This happened at 5:30 in the morning, this most recent one. But you assume that there's got to be several people on the bridge, and wouldn't the radar pick up that? I mean,
So the challenge in an environment like this, which is a combination of poor visibility, so the Fitzgerald accident happened in the dead of night, the McCain in the early dawn, still sort of dusk and darkness, so limited visibility, and a crowded and potentially sort of complicated sort of situation with many ships in the Strait of Malacca is a quite congested waterway. So in that case in particular, you're constantly trying to keep track of multiple contacts, multiple vessels moving in all different directions. So the radar can help you to maintain a situational awareness, but a radar doesn't steer the ship. A radar doesn't make orders to turn port or starboard. At the end of the day, that is the responsibility of the conning officer, the officer of the deck, and the helmsman. And so while it's true that we have exquisite technology that is able to locate vessels in poor visibility, it's more complicated than that in terms of navigating a ship safely.
Well, we know that there have been disciplinary actions taken as a result of the Fitzgerald collision, including the captain himself, right? I think he wasn't decommissioned?
He will lose his he will lose his commission. That's correct, as part of the finding, or he will receive censure, which effectively ends his career. There are, as with most ships, there are standing orders that pertain to when the captain is to be notified, when a vessel is expected to come within a certain distance from the ship. And my reading of the review of the Fitzgerald incident is that those standing orders were completely ignored or missed. It was obvious that this vessel that they were tracking was going to come fairly close to the ship, but they didn't take evasive maneuvers quickly enough. In the case of McCain, we don't know yet, again, whether this is a combination of, if it's purely a case of human error or if there are also potentially some equipment failures. Those also occur from time to time where you have, equipment that doesn't function as it's supposed to, which can compound a problem. It's still too soon to say in terms of what the circumstances are of that incident.
And again, I'm speaking with Christopher Preble, who is the Vice President for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. He's the author of The Power Problem, How American Military Dominance Makes Us Feel Less Safe, Less Prosperous, and Less Free. And he co-edited with John Mueller, A Dangerous World, Threat Perceptions, and U.S. National Security. Preble was a commissioned officer in the United States Navy and served aboard the USS Ticonderoga. Well, just to finish up on the Fitzgerald Inquiry, which was just released a few weeks ago, there was not only the captain, but a dozen sailors were disciplined, including two top officers and two top enlisted sailors. Right. And the Vice Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral William Moran, said that the sailors who were on watch in the ship's bridge, quote, lost situational awareness.
Right.
Is that a euphemism for what?
Well, situational awareness means quite literally being able to tell your surroundings, being able to judge the different ships or obstacles that are around your own vessel and being able to avoid them. This is what we were talking about earlier in terms of the radar can assist with that and visual can assist with that. And it appears that the situation became quite confused. They were unable to judge accurately and safely evasive maneuvers. Another point that I want to emphasize is my reading of the Fitzgerald incident is one of the great tragedies is the failure to, in a timely fashion, sound a collision alarm, which even a few seconds of advanced warning would have possibly helped those in the berthing area that were where the lives were lost. These people were asleep in their racks when the collision occurred, and so even just a few seconds of warning, I think was another in a long train of missed opportunities to avoid this tragic accident.
And seven sailors died in that accident with Fitzgerald, and 10 are missing now from the USS John S. McCain. Four were injured and have been treated. One has been discharged. And the U.S. Navy has ordered a worldwide operational pause. So what do you think is going on in terms of the whole United States Navy at this moment?
Well, you have operational pause or a training stand down when there are a series of accidents, and it's really an opportunity for everyone to revisit the entirety of training and procedures and reviewing what people's requirements and responsibilities are. We have these from time to time when there's an aviation accident or when there are collisions at sea or other incidents involving, you know, personnel issues, things like that. It happens from time to time where people are sort of compelled to stop, think through what they're supposed to do in a crisis situation, and hopefully with that pause and additional training and review, avoid these sorts of things in the future.
So what do you make of some of the analysis coming from naval analysts and former naval officers suggesting that there's this high tempo of operations? As you know, things have ramped up in the South China Sea because of the Chinese building these islands, turning these islets into bases, and, of course, the North Korea situation. And these two, Ticonderoga and the John McCain, are both Aegis-guided missiles destroyers. They're supposed to be a part of a kind of anti-missile cordon, I guess, along with the THAAD system. And how much do you think that is a contribution, the idea that even though we have a huge Navy, it's being tasked to do too much at the moment?
Well, in the case of the Fitzgerald and McCain, I think that they are operating in a high-tempo environment, an environment that has become more contested over the last several years. But in the incidents we're talking about, in the case of the Strait of Malacca and not far from Japan, those areas have been areas that the U.S. Navy has been operating in for, frankly, decades. So I do think it's a little premature to attribute to two tragic accidents a pattern that's associated with a higher operational tempo. That ultimately, that may be the determination if we find, for example, that training has been sort of cut back, or if there is not sufficient guidance in terms of safe operations. but I think it's too soon to say. And, you know, what I know from the Fitzgerald incident, that does not appear to have been a function of a high operational environment, as I read the report.
So it's not a case of this massively sophisticated high-tech ship, and these ships, I should say, for this mm-hmm. year, being in the hands of people that just simply aren't trained. I mean, it's not like having an expensive Ferrari and handing the keys over to a teenager that doesn't have a driver's license.
Well, let's be clear. The U.S. Navy ships have been operated by teenagers for, again, decades, centuries even. And so it is not unusual for an 18, 19, or 20-year-old helmsman to be holding in his hands, in this case, a $2.5 billion vessel. That is the way the Navy has operated for a very long time. I think it's premature to suggest that poor training on the part of young enlisted people who are controlling the ship is necessarily the cause of this latest accident. In the case of the Fitzgerald, as you've already noted, there were a number of people that were held responsible for failing to follow procedures, and the training for a helmsman or for a lookout or for an officer of the deck entails many different layers of situational awareness and safe operating practices and those sorts of things. So training is incredibly important to the safe operation of the naval vessel, as it is with any other branch of service. But I think it's not obvious to me that the problems that we've seen here, tragically in South Pacific and East Asia, are attributed to inadequate training.
And in terms of the Seventh Fleet's overall capability, losing three ships, what percentage? Do you have any idea?
Not off the top of my head, no, I'm afraid I don't. It would be, at any one time, the U.S. Navy would operate maybe, I don't even know mm-hmm. what the numbers of ships would be in any one time, so that's I wouldn't want to speculate on that. But I suspect that the responsibilities that had fallen to the Fitzgerald and McCain obviously are going to have to be picked up by other ships.
Right, but I think the Seventh Fleet is the biggest fleet of the U.S. Navy, right?
Yes, absolutely, and growing as the United States has progressively shifted more and more of its attention and assets from the Atlantic and the East to the Pacific and the West.
So the 10 missing sailors, the big hole in the side of it apparently, was also, as it was in the Fitzgerald, in a berthing compartment. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. is that the expectation, that the sailors were drowned?
Well, I wouldn't want to speculate on that, especially since the investigation is still ongoing and loved ones haven't been notified and all that sort of thing. Right. But it is true that when the hull of the ship is punctured and a space is exposed to seawater, those spaces can fill up very, very quickly. And that's certainly what happened in the case of the Fitzgerald. You had a hit that hit both the superstructure up high, where the captain's quarters were, as well as a hit below decks, where the water came in. Again, I've just sort of glanced at the pictures of the McCain, and I haven't got a full picture of that. But it also appears to have been struck both above the waterline and below the waterline. So that would suggest that water had come into some of the spaces below decks.
Well, let's just, in the last couple of minutes then, Christopher Preble, talk about the work that you do at the Cato Institute and your book, The Power Problem, How American Military Dominance Makes Us Less Safe, Less Prosperous, and Less Free in this context. You mentioned that this is a $2.5 billion ship we're talking about, John S. McCain.
That's right.
That's right.
So the Aegis class destroyers, the Arleigh Burke class destroyers, are really the foundation for the surface navy. We still have cruisers very similar to the ship that I deployed on many years ago, the Ticonderoga class. Now later models, but using the same technology. and you know, they're really the backbone of the surface fleet. They are exceptionally capable, and the crews are you know, typically very, very well trained, very motivated, and really the finest around. I absolutely still believe that's the case, and I believe that the Navy is critical to sort of maintaining U.S. protecting U.S. interests, not just here in this hemisphere, but overseas as well. The work that I do and my colleagues here at the Cato Institute focuses more on sort of the big picture of the foreign policy, what objectives are we trying to achieve, and what is the best means to achieve them. And I think, especially with respect to the land wars that the United States has been fighting over since the end, since 9/11, that the costs are quite high, the benefits are dubious at best, and I think not so surprisingly, you see quite a bit of resistance among the public at large for expanding these wars or for adding new ones. That doesn't mean, however, that there's not still strong public support for the military as an institution, for the men and women who serve in the military, and for a strong and capable fighting force. I think that's all still very much widely supported here in the United States, and the question really is sort of how, when do we use this force and under what circumstances, and how do we weigh the cost and benefits? That's really where we focus a lot of our work here at Cato.
But do you focus on, for example, the weapon systems? We have the F-35, the most expensive weapon system in history.
Yes.
And lots of questions about it. And there's been a long-standing questions about whether we're getting our money's worth in terms mm-hmm. of these gold-plated weapon systems, whether we could a Timex would do instead of a Rolex.
Right. I wrote about the F-35 program many, many years ago, and was sort of cautiously optimistic that the benefits of a multi-service fighter, this is an aircraft that is supposed to be used by the Air Force, the Marine Corps, and the Navy, that there would be important sort of economies of scale. It hasn't played out that way at all. The three aircraft are quite different. There are not nearly the sort of commonality of parts and equipment that one would expect. And that means that the costs have grown so high that a number of our international partners who had signed on to the F-35 program have effectively been priced out of it, or at least feeling a bit of buyer's remorse. So I think it's important to scrutinize these weapon systems on a case-by-case basis and ask, as you say, the question, is the capabilities, are the capabilities that we're buying, are they quite literally worth the cost? And I think many times the capabilities drive cost in a way that that if someone sort of stepped back and assessed more critically, then those programs would be shut down or at least wound down before they become the multi-billion dollar monstrosity that the F-35 program has become.
Well, Christopher Preble, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Sure, my pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Christopher Preble, who is the Vice President for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. He is the author of The Power Problem, How American Military Dominance Makes Us Less Safe, Less Prosperous, and Less Free. And he co-edited with John Mueller, A Dangerous World, Threat Perception, and U.S. National Security. And he was a commissioned officer in the United States Navy and served aboard the USS Ticonderoga. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.